Welcome to Old Testament Study 16. This is called the Crumbling South. Just like last week, we looked at the Crumbling North. This week, we're going to look at the Crumbling South. We're going to talk about the what happened to the southern nation of Judah. And we're going to cover its whole history. And as we found last week when we tried to talk about the Crumbling North, there's just so much to cover. And it was more than we could handle in one recording. In fact, we made two very long recordings. So, likewise, we're going to do the same here. In our classes, on Sunday morning, we're splitting up the South in half. This lesson is going to be covered in two different weeks, and so we'll do the same with this recording. In the Monday night class, though, in the in-depth class, we covered the whole study all in one night. So, let's get into it. Let's remind ourselves a little bit about what we learned over the last couple of weeks with the Crumbling North and what happened there. If you can turn to your picture, and we'll kind of walk through that a little bit. In page one of your handout, we'll do a little kind of test to see how much you remember, and just kind of walk through some of the highlights of the things that we talked about over the last couple of weeks. So we started out actually a few weeks before this. We talked about the United Kingdom, how all of Israel was together, united under one king during the reign of Saul, during the reign of David, and during the reign of Solomon. And things were in line to do the same. God had promised to each of those kings that if you're faithful to me, if you follow me, if you walk in my ways, if you lead my people to be faithful to me, then I will be with you and I will give you a dynasty that lasts forever. I will always have a descendant of yours on the throne. And we saw that Saul had trouble with faithfulness. He had trouble with people too. And so that didn't stay. In fact, his dynasty ended. And God gave the kingdom to a man who was a man after his own heart, and that was David. And although we saw that David had trouble with being perfect, as all humans do, he still remained faithful to God throughout. And as a result, God kept his promise and continued to have a descendant of David's on the throne forever. You know, who's a descendant today? Jesus. Descendant of David, it's on the throne now. After David was Solomon. Now, Solomon started out well, and for probably most of his kingship, or a good chunk of it, he kind of walked in the ways of his father and was faithful to God. But towards the end, we see that he had married lots of wives for political reasons. And towards the end, he started succumbing to them in terms of building temples to their gods, because these wives were royalty from other nations around. That was the political reasons. And they brought their own gods, and he supported that. He built temples to their gods. He even went with them and worshiped those gods. And as a result, what did God decide to do? He decided he was going to split the kingdom, that he was going to take the kingdom from Solomon and give it to someone else. But for the sake of the faithfulness of David, number one, he wouldn't do it during the reign of Solomon. He would wait until Solomon's son Rehoboam would have to deal with that. And he wouldn't tear the whole nation away. He would split it. He would give 10 tribes to this other person and give one tribe to David, to David's descendants, to Solomon's descendants. Now, how does the 1 plus 10 equal 12? Because there were 12 tribes. Well, because Simeon, if you look at a map, that was right in the middle of Judah. And by this time, Simeon and Judah had kind of integrated. And so the nation of Judah was really composed of Simeon and Judah. And to be honest, a little bit of Benjamin, too. That's why it split. It's because of Solomon's faithlessness, because Solomon was not a man after God's heart and did not maintain faithfulness throughout his whole life like his father David had done. So the northern 10 tribes were going to go to another guy named Jeroboam. Jeroboam was an official in Solomon's government. And how did he learn that he was going to become king? He didn't decide to do it. God decided to do it. God sent the prophet Ahijah to him, who said, God's going to give you the nation. And he made the same promise to Jeroboam that he had made to Saul, David, and Solomon, that if you're faithful to me, that I will be with you, I will bless you, and you will always have a descendant on the throne. And so that's how Jeroboam found out that he would become king. Then when the time came, when Solomon died, Rehoboam took over, and things were in line for him to be able to be king over the whole United Kingdom. But it wasn't God's plan, was it? So what happened that resulted in God's plan being fulfilled in terms of having the kingdom split? Well, the people came to Rehoboam and said, "Hey, we'll make you king over all of us, but you got to lighten the load. Your dad taxed us heavily, forced us into labor. If you lighten the load, we'll follow you." Rehoboam said, "Well, give me a few days to think about it." He thought about it. He talked to his father's elders, his father's advisors, and they said, "Great idea, do it, and you'll endear yourself to the people." His young buck friends said, no, tell him, "Hey, I'm going to make it even tougher on you." And so he went with his young buck friends, and that's what he told them. They said, "Okay, adios, see you later." And they went and rallied themselves around Jeroboam. And Rehoboam was then left with just the one tribe of Judah. Now, this is a civil split. This is a civil war, okay? He has lost the bulk of his nation. What would the normal approach be? The normal response to that would be to go and get it back. Go and fight Jeroboam. Go and fight these leaders that have pulled the nation away. Well, Rehoboam planned to do that. And he started to do that. But God stopped him and God said, "Hey, don't do it, because this is not Jeroboam's doing, this is my doing. And if you try to go and fight Jeroboam, you're only going to lose. And don't fight me." What I find amazing is that Rehoboam obeyed. He recognized God's calling. I mean, that's a pretty big step to back off and say, "No, I'm not going to go fight for my nation." But he didn't, because he recognized that this was God telling him this was his will. And so he backed off and did not go attack Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam now has a new nation, and Jeroboam is faced with a situation, because the nation that's been there before, up till now, had a central capital, Jerusalem. That's where the political capital was, the capital of the nation. It was also where the religious capital was, the temple to God and all of that. Well, he couldn't, that was no longer in his territory, that was in Judah. You know, we had talked about how Jerusalem was on the border between Judah and the other tribes. Well, the next tribe up was Benjamin, and part of Benjamin sided with Judah, and so that meant that Jerusalem was now inside Judah territory, not on the border any longer. So, Jeroboam sets up his own capital, his own state, national capital. And where does he do that? He starts out in Shechem. Okay, Shechem, which is about where he's from. And then later on in his reign, he changes that to Tirzah. And we see that it remains in Tirzah for a while until the time of Zimri. Okay, if you remember, Zimri was the guy who assassinated Baasha's son Elah. And then Omri was the commander of the army at the time. And when he heard what Zimri had done, he had come and besieged Tirzah, the national capital, to get to Zimri. Zimri burned down the palace all around him and killed himself there. Well, Omri now becomes king, and he doesn't have a palace. And he decides, rather than rebuilding the palace where it was, I'm going to build a whole new city. And so he goes and buys this hill from a guy named Shemer and sets up a city there and names it after this guy, calls it Shemeria, or we know it as Samaria. And so that's where the capital of the northern nation of Israel was for the rest of its existence. Then what about the religious aspect? Because this is a theocratic, a God-led nation. Well, Jeroboam was concerned that people who would go to Jerusalem, his people, would be going into his enemy's territory, into Rehoboam's territory, and could turn on him. Okay, could pledge their allegiance to Rehoboam. So rather than having that, he made up his own religion. So he did not walk in the way of the Lord. He made up his own religion and set up golden calves in Dan way up in the north and Bethel in the south, so people could go to either one, and said, "These are your gods, O Israel, the gods who brought you out of Egypt," and worship them. He made up his own festivals and feasts, okay, that didn't coincide, that weren't the same as what the Israelites had and what God had commanded. He appointed anybody who wanted to be priest, they could apply and become priests, so it wasn't the Levites. And in fact, the Levites left, the faithful Levites and the faithful people left and went down south to Judah, thereby strengthening Judah. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. There we see that Jeroboam himself, and he led Israel astray and led them towards these other gods, this other religion that he had made up. And we see that on our picture, that the piece that corresponds to Jeroboam in the upper top, middle, left, whatever, has that golden calf on it. And that reminds us of the religion that Jeroboam set up, and setting up golden calves and religious shrines at Dan and Bethel, and that thereby leading Israel astray. We see that as we walk through the rest of the kings, that not a one of them turned back to God. Okay? There were pluses and minuses, but in all cases, they all walked in the ways of Jeroboam. They all continued that religion that Jeroboam started here. They did not return back to Yahweh worship and faithfulness to Yahweh. So if you look at page 10, where we have our chart of the quality of all the kings, you see in the kings on the right-hand side for Israel, they were all bad. Okay, there was not a good one in terms of their faithfulness among them. So as a result, God, what did God do? Well, God was very patient. Look at this. Their existence lasted 220-something years. And throughout that, God kept sending his prophets, and we talked about that a few weeks ago, how he sent the prophets to call them back to him, to remind them of their destiny, to be faithful to him, to remind them of their destiny, to be blessed, to be a blessing. And it didn't work. But he continued to be patient with them so that eventually he did follow through with his judgment by bringing the Assyrians and having the Assyrians come in and not just beat up, but destroy the northern nation of Israel. The Assyrians were a very vicious people. They wiped out and killed the bulk of the Israelites. The ones they didn't kill, they exiled, and they took and they scattered them throughout their empire. They didn't just take them to one place so that there was Israel town over in Assyria. They scattered them throughout so that they ceased to exist as a people. They intermixed with other peoples, and there are no more of the Israelites of the northern nation that were wiped out by the Assyrians. Okay? And then likewise, what the Assyrians would do is they took other peoples that they conquered and they would settle them throughout their empire, which included Samaria. So they brought a bunch of people and dumped a bunch of people into the land of the northern nation of Israel. And those people were called Samaritans. So that at the time of Jesus, those were the people that thought they were brothers to the Jews, but the Jews said, "You have no relation to us. You are not part of God's, the people that God called." And rightfully so, because they were other peoples. There was no Jewish blood. There was no Israelite blood in those people. Okay? And we talked about that before. All right? Now, as we look at the picture, you see that there's three colors of these various kings. The top ones you see are dark gray, dismal looking. And that reminds us that during those kings, Israel was under a period of civil strife. It all started with Jeroboam splitting and taking part of the nation of Israel away from Rehoboam. And so we see that there was warfare between the north and the south. This was all civil war kind of times. And it lasted for 100 years. Then the next section we see is kind of, is golden area. Well, that's another 100 years. And that was a time of wealth and prosperity. But as we saw, that time of wealth and prosperity did not mean it was a time of faithfulness to God. That it was not considered a good time for Israel. And then we have the orange turning to red, and there we have a period of rapid decline. Rapid decline, just 20-something years. Now, looking at the top part, the period of civil strife, who were Israel's enemies during this time? Well, obviously Judah, right? That was a period of civil strife. So during that time, they had civil strife. They had Judah as an enemy. And then the enemy on the other side of them was Syria. And they had a lot of trouble with Syria during that time. These dynasties, okay, the promise that God made to Jeroboam, if you're faithful to me, I will give you a dynasty that lasts forever. And how faithful was Jeroboam? He wasn't. He made up his own religion. He led Israel astray. And as a result, God wiped out his dynasty. Okay? When his son Nadab came in, his son didn't last very long and was wiped out by Baasha. Okay? So his dynasty, Jeroboam's dynasty, was eliminated because he had made other gods. God made the same promise to Baasha and said, if you're faithful to me, if you lead my people in faith, I will bless you and I will give you a dynasty that lasts forever. And Baasha did what? He followed in the ways of Jeroboam and continued the sins of Jeroboam by worshiping those gods and leading people astray. So as a result, he was evil in God's eyes and God treated his family the same way. After his son Ela took over, he allowed Zimri to come and wipe out Baasha's family. Okay. Even though Zimri was only around for 7 days, he effectively and was effective in wiping out Baasha's family. And so they were eliminated. Well, then Zimri, well, he didn't last long, and Omri became king. And Omri's dynasty, we went from Omri to Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram. But then what happened? God raised up Jehu, and he eliminated Omri's dynasty, okay, because they were evil in God's eyes. Not only did they follow in the sins of Jeroboam, in fact, it says that Omri found it trivial to continue in the sins of Jeroboam. They added many other sins, not the least of which was bringing in Baal worship. And that was Ahab's wife Jezebel who brought that in. Jezebel was the was a princess of the Sidonians, the daughter of the king of Sidon. And she brought in worship of Baal, the Baal of Sidon, and brought the worst time for the time of Israel. And we see that with that snake on the Ahab segment there, and that talks about the period of Baalism that was brought in during Ahab. We also see a volcano there on Omri with some coins, and that reminds us that during the reigns of Baasha to Omri, Israel was threatened heavily by Syria, and in fact had to pay tribute to Syria, was subject to Syria during that time. Now, also we see some flags here, some banners on Ahab. During the depths of Israel's deepest, most faithless time, God reached out and brought his heavy hitter, Elijah, heavy hitter prophet, to come and remind them that Baal is not God, but Yahweh is God. In fact, that's what Elijah's name even was Eliyah, or Yahweh is God. And you had this great Baal showdown that the people then came to realize that, yes, Yahweh is God. And all of that happened during this time. And then when Elijah was taken to heaven in the chariots of fire, Elisha succeeded him and continued his ministry. You see that their banners are black and white, black signifying the message of the prophet of warning, of gloom, of doom, of if you continue to reject God, he will reject you and punish you. But the white, representing the hope, representing the grace. God's a God of sin. We've seen the cycle of sin, judgment, grace. God's a God of judgment. He's a just God, and he punishes sin, but he's also a merciful and loving God that offers his grace that we don't deserve. That's what grace is. And we see that throughout these the prophets, the messages that they brought. And we'll talk more about that in a couple of weeks after we talk about the south. Now, we also see that Ahab is the last one that's got that dark color, the period of civil strife. So why is that? Well, we'll talk more about this today, but Ahab improved relations with Judah by giving his daughter Athaliah to Jehoram, who was the son of the king of the south, Jehoshaphat. And so we had an alliance by marriage that resulted in mending the civil strife so that now Israel and Judah were no longer enemies. And this was not the good thing for Judah. Okay, it was a good thing for Israel, but it was not a good thing for Judah. And we'll talk about that more today. Now then we go into this period of wealth and prosperity. Israel's enemies during this period, well, it's no longer Judah. And really, Assyria wasn't on the front yet, but Syria was still the problem. And so Israel had to deal with Syria. You had Ben-Hadad, you had Hazael, and you had another Ben-Hadad that were all problems for them during this time. Now we see that Jehu was the best, okay, king of Israel. If you look at the chart, it says bad mostly. Why? Well, he was considered the best because he wiped out the Baal worship. He not only purged Israel of all of Omri's family and descendants and brought God's judgment upon Omri and his dynasty that way, as God had instructed him to do, but he also wiped out the Baals, got rid of all the Baal prophets, got rid of all the Baal temples and shrines and Asherah poles and stuff like that, and removed that from Israel. So because of his faithfulness in doing that, God promised that he would have four generations on the throne. Why just four? Why not an enduring dynasty like he had given to David? Because Jehu was bad mostly. Okay, he was not good because even though he wiped out the Baal worship, he did not eliminate the worship of the gods that Jeroboam had made. And so Jeroboam's god worship continued during the time of Jehu. We see also during this time, you see on the segment for Jeroboam II, that the flags of Hosea and Amos, and you see they're black and white, and these prophets came and brought warnings to the people about spiritual laxness during a period of prosperity, during the golden age. Well, you know, we live in a period of prosperity. Is there a concern about spiritual laxness today for us? Absolutely. Just look around. Faithlessness is all around. When things are economically well, when things are prosperous, people say, oh, look what I can do. I don't need God. And that's the warning that Hosea and Amos brought. We then have the age of rapid decline. And looking at this, we see Menahem, we see this volcano, but now it's not just a volcano like we had on Omri, but this is an erupting volcano. This is a big one. This is Assyria. This is the one that becomes the big empire builder. This becomes a world empire, and Israel is right in the way. And Israel kind of fights back, and that creates problems. You see that under Menahem, Assyria becomes a violent threat to Israel's freedom. The coins there remind us that they had to start paying tribute, that they became subject to Assyria, which the future kings didn't really like. And we found some times where they rebelled. And we see, for an example, under the Pekah segment there, you've got that manuscript on Pekah. And that reminds us that Pekah allied himself with Aram, that is Syria, against Judah and Assyria. Judah was a vassal of Assyria, just like Israel was. Israel wanted to get out of it. Israel and Syria teamed up and said, okay, we got to fight against this. And so they first fought the easy one, that was Judah. Well, Judah sent word to Assyria saying, hey, we're your people, you come protect us. And Assyria did, and this was a big problem for the nation of Israel. Then we have the Isaiah banner there. You see it's both black and white because of the two messages that the prophets brought. And Isaiah, it was really a prophet more so to the south. You can see that on your chart on page 10. And Isaiah came at this time with a big part of Isaiah's message was to warn the southern nation of Judah not to fall into the problems and the ways of the northern nation of Israel. Okay? And take a look at what's happening to the northern nation of Israel, and that will happen to you if you continue to be unfaithful to God. And so Isaiah came at that time. But we also see that Isaiah did prophesy that the northern nation of Israel would be destroyed, would be eliminated. And we looked at that verse last week. And then under Hosea, we've got a manuscript peg there. Hosea, and his attempt to try to deal with this Assyrian problem, is he allied himself with Egypt, another major power. Okay? And that didn't work. And then the dark red color of the reign of Hosea reminds us that it was under Hosea that full-scale destruction came to the northern kingdom of Israel during his reign in 722 BC. And we also see that by the whole crumbling nature, the overall portrayal of the crumbling kingdom reminds us of the whole disintegration of this nation. Why? Because they were not faithful to God. Okay, so that's what we talked about the last couple of weeks. That's quite a lengthy review, but it was an important review and maybe put everything into perspective there for you. So let's move forward. Let's say, okay, well, let's go backwards in time and talk then about Judah, the other nation, the nation of the south. Well, first let's talk about some differences there, because there were differences. There's not only in the faithfulness, which we'll talk about, but also just the nations themselves. Take a look at how they're settled. If you look at the geography of Judah, Judah's down in the south, and as you go further south, what do you have? Desert. A big part of Judah is called the Negev, which is desertous and moving into desert kind of area. So it was not as fertile of an area. Didn't have as much rain, didn't have as good of crops, couldn't raise as good of livestock. It was not the part of the land that was flowing with milk and honey. That was more the northern area. So as a result, Judah was not very attractive to outsiders as far as the land. And Judah is pretty isolated. The only major power that it touched on was Egypt, and that was across miles and miles of desert. So the other power they touched on was Israel. All the other neighbors around, well, you had Philistia over there, but Philistia was more so focused on the northern part because of the lushness there. And so there wasn't that much threatening, and some of the roads that went to Judah really kind of went around Judah. Versus Israel, all that's just the opposite. Israel was the center of major trade routes. You had major trade routes going right through the middle of Israel. It was very attractive to outsiders. Outsiders saw it. Outsiders saw how fertile it was. It was very exposed geographically and influenced by other nations. There were nations, all sorts of nations, all around them. Not only Syria, but Edom and Ammon and you've got Tyre and Sidon and Lebanon and all of these influences from all over. And they were in line of the Assyrian expansion. Assyria wanted to be the world power, wanted to take over the world, and Israel was right in line for that. Dynasties. Okay, these dynasties we looked at over the last couple of weeks, there were 9 different dynasties in the north, in the northern nation of Israel. And of those, only 2 of them lasted over 2 generations. So, and how did they become king? Well, they decided they wanted to become king, and they wiped out the others, and not the kind of kingship that God had in mind, right? But you take a look, you know, Jeroboam lasted 2 dynasties, or 2 generations. Baasha lasted 2. Zimri was 1. Okay, and then you have Omri that lasted a few and Jehu that lasted a few. All the others were just 1 or 2. On the other hand, Judah will see, as we go through today's and next week, all the kings were from the line of David. And that was in line with the promise that God had made to David. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 11, starting at verse 34. It says, I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. This is God talking to Jeroboam. I will give 1 tribe to his son so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. So you see that God had decided, God had promised, God was going to fulfill his promise to David, that he would always have a lamp in Jerusalem, always have a descendant on the throne. And so that's what we see. All the kings in the south were from the lineage of David. Faithfulness. Well, what about Israel? Not a one of them was faithful. They all sinned and fell short of the glory of God. Well, we do too. They all followed the sins of Jeroboam by following the gods of Jeroboam and leading the people astray. In Judah, though, we'll see as we walk through that on occasion they would return to God. We see a lot of them that were bad, that were not faithful, but we see some that were good. and some that did turn back to God, and we'll walk through some of that today. We saw for Israel there were three eras: the era of civil strife, the era of wealth and prosperity, and the era of rapid decline. Well, we see the same eras with Judah. But Judah lasted a little longer, so there's a few other eras in there too. In fact, I've given you on your chart on page 2, 6 different periods in Judah's history, starting out with a period of civil strife, and then after the civil strife ended through Jehoshaphat, during the reign of Jehoshaphat, we then kind of go into a golden age, but we really need to point out there's a period of Baalism that resulted from the alliance, and we'll talk about this today, the alliance that Judah made with Israel during the time of Ahab, and brought that Ahab Baalism in. Then you had this golden age, okay, and then a period of decline, just like we had the decline in the northern nation, but then a period of reform, but then it flipped around again, and we have this time of destruction. So that's what we're going to see. We'll go through up through the Baalism time today, and then next week we'll cover from Joash to Zedekiah. Now you'll find the same sort of format as you go through the books of the Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, as you go through these stories. In the whatever year of so-and-so who was the king of Israel at the time, this new king of Judah began to reign. It'll say that. So rather than saying in 1984 so-and-so became president or whatever, you know, rather than referring to a year, they refer to the year of the reign of the other king. So that's how we're able to come up with the chart that you see on page 10. You get some details about his age, the length of his reign, the name, and his queen mother, typically. Then there's a comparison of his reign with the reign of that of David, his father. Okay, David, his father, being the reference point to which they're all referred to in the faithfulness of David and his relationship with God. And then it says, now the rest of the acts of so-and-so, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? And then there's a final statement that he slept with his fathers and that so-and-so reigned in his stead. So you'll see this common pattern as you go through. Now I'll mention that we also have a couple other books that we're going to be looking at. In fact, we'll probably read more out of 1st and 2nd Chronicles or out of 2nd Chronicles than we will out of the Kings. And you'll see they cover the same ground. In fact, some of the parallels that you'll find between the two are verbatim, the exact same words. But the thing that you have that's different is the books of 1st and 2nd Kings tell us the stories of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, the kings of both the north and the south, whereas the books of the Chronicles focus on the stories of the kings of the south, of Judah. So we get more detail in 1st and 2nd Chronicles about the kings of the south. And so that's why we'll be looking more at those today. Okay? Well, let's dive in. Let's take a look. We'll take a look at our picture here, and you'll see a similar sort of picture to what we had before. It's not quite as falling apart as what we had before, because we've got these hands holding it together. And so those hands are really maybe crushing it, okay? And we'll talk about that as we get to the end. Actually, next week we'll mention that. So let's start off. You see up at the top we have Rehoboam. So who was Rehoboam and how faithful was his reign? 1 Kings chapter 14 verses 21 to 24. It says, Rehoboam, son of Solomon, was king in Judah. So we see that he was the son of Solomon. He was the next in line. He was a descendant of David. He was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel in which to put his name. His mother's name was Naamah. She was an Ammonite. So we see Rehoboam was only half Jewish, only half Israelite. His mom was an Ammonite. So we have some foreign blood here. Judah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. By the sins they committed, they stirred up his jealous anger more than their fathers had done. They also set up for themselves high places, sacred stones, and Asherah poles on every high hill and under every spreading tree. There were even male shrine prostitutes in the land. The people engaged in all the detestable practices of the nation that the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. So we see the time of Rehoboam was not faithful. Okay, it was bad mostly. You can see on the technical term on page 10, right? So he was a son of Solomon and Naamah, this Ammonite, and he had other gods. Okay? So not a good start. Not a good first king here. Was there any faithfulness in Judah during Rehoboam's reign? Well, look at 2 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 13 through 17. This tells us some interesting stuff because Rehoboam's kicking this off. He's the first king of this southern nation of Judah. What's going to happen? We already have seen that the northern nation has rejected God, and now we have Rehoboam rejecting God too. But look at chapter 11 of 2 Chronicles. It says, "The priests and the Levites from all their districts throughout Israel, the northern nation, sided with Rehoboam. The Levites even abandoned their pasture lands and property and came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons had rejected them as priests of the Lord. And he appointed his own priests for the high places and for the goat and the calf idols that he had made. Those from every tribe of Israel who set their hearts on seeking Yahweh, the God of Israel, they followed the Levites to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices to Yahweh, the God of their fathers. They therefore strengthened the kingdom of Judah, and they supported Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, for 3 years, walking in the ways of David and Solomon during this time." So we see that the faithful in the north were abhorred by what Jeroboam did in creating this religion, and they left. And they moved south. They gave up their property. The Levites, the faithful, they went and they moved south to Judah. So even though Rehoboam was following other gods and leading Judahites to follow other gods, you still had a higher concentration growth of the faithful to Yahweh because of them leaving the northern nation of Israel. Okay? Now it says that they strengthened them for 3 years. Why 3 years? 2 Chronicles 12, verse 1, "After Rehoboam's position as king was established and he had become strong, he and all of Israel with him abandoned the law of the Lord." Now, that's one of the things the king could do. Now, the king sets the example for faith for the people, and that's why it's so important to God that the king was faithful and would lead the people in faith. So we already had Rehoboam leading people away, but now, when he felt that he was in power and, hey, I'm in control of this, after 3 years, he then led the people away from God's law. Okay? God's law had been a big part of the law of the nation, and then he retreated from that, and that further led the people away from God. We had already talked about this, but let's just read some verses here. Why didn't Rehoboam fight Jeroboam to recapture the northern 10 tribes? Chapter 11, it says, "When Rehoboam arrived in Jerusalem, he mustered the house of Judah and Benjamin, 180,000 fighting men, to make war against Israel and to regain the kingdom for Rehoboam. But this word of the Lord came to Shemaiah, the man of God, 'Say to Rehoboam, son of Solomon, king of Judah, and to all the Israelites in Judah and Benjamin, this is what the Lord says, do not go and fight against your brothers. Go home, every one of you, for this is my doing.'" And what amazes me, especially with an idol worshiper like Rehoboam, they obeyed the words of Yahweh and turned back from marching against Jeroboam. So they didn't go fight because God, he wanted to, but God stopped him. And he actually listened to God. That's what surprises me in this story, because you wouldn't expect that of Rehoboam here. Well, did the two kingdoms become peaceful neighbors then because he didn't go fight them? 1 Kings 14, verse 30 says, "There was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam." So no, we had a civil war. We did have fighting. We didn't have the major go and take him back by mega force effort from Rehoboam. But you had continual skirmishes between the north and the south and troubles the whole time. So what did Rehoboam find to be his most important project as king of Judah? Chapter 11. Verse 5 says that Rehoboam lived in Jerusalem and built up towns for defense in Judah. And then we've got these towns, Bethlehem, Etam, Tekoa, Bethzur, Soko, Adullam, Gath, Merishah, Ziph, Edoraim, Lachish, Azekah, Zorah, Ajalon, and Hebron. Okay, these were fortified cities in Judah and Benjamin. He strengthened their defenses and put commanders in them with supplies of food, olive oil, and wine. He put shields and spears in all the cities and made them very strong. So Judah and Benjamin, the southern part of Benjamin, were his. And then skipping forward to verse 22, Rehoboam appointed Abijah, son of Maacah, which is, Maacah was one of his wives, to be the chief prince among his brothers in order to make him king. He acted wisely, dispersing some of his sons throughout the districts of Judah and Benjamin into all the fortified cities. He gave them abundant provisions and took many wives for them. So, Rehoboam's focus during his kingship was to build up the defenses of his nation. There was a time of peace during his father. His father was Solomon. His name meant peace, and he brought peace. So there wasn't a lot of need, even though Solomon had major construction projects and, in fact, made some fortified cities. It wasn't as important to him as it was during the time of Rehoboam. Rehoboam brought a time of warfare, and he needed to strengthen his defenses, so he built fortified cities and put his kids in charge of them and taught them leadership that way and made his oldest son, Abijah, the chief prince to kind of prepare him to be the next king. So that's what he did. Now, Rehoboam was not faithful to God. How did God respond to that? Chapter 12, starting in verse 2. Because they had been unfaithful to Yahweh, Shishak, king of Egypt, attacked Jerusalem in the fifth year of King Rehoboam with 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen and innumerable troops of Libyans, Succites, and Cushites that came with him from Egypt. He captured the fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. So all these cities that Rehoboam had focused on fortifying, Shishak came and attacked and captured, okay, was victorious over those. So all that work went to naught. Then the prophet Shemaiah came to Rehoboam and to the leaders of Judah who had assembled in Jerusalem for the fear of Shishak. And he said to him, "This is what Yahweh says. You have abandoned me. Therefore, I now abandon you to Shishak." Okay? I'm going to let Shishak come in and destroy you and wipe out this new nation of Judah. Here we are, the very first king of this southern nation of Judah, and they're going to get wiped out because of his faithlessness. You see God's response to that. The leaders and the king humbled themselves and said, "The Lord is just." You're right. We deserve that. Okay? We deserve what God is planning to do, and we're not going to fight against it because God is right. Well, when Yahweh saw that they had humbled themselves, then this word of Yahweh came to Shemaiah. "Since they've humbled themselves, I will not destroy them, but I'll soon give them deliverance. My wrath will not be poured out on Jerusalem through Shishak. They will, however, become subject to him so that they can learn the difference between serving me and serving the kings of other lands." So Shishak, king of Egypt, when he attacked Jerusalem, he carried off the treasures of the temple of Yahweh and the treasures of the royal palace. He took everything, including the gold shields that Solomon had made. And then verse 12, "Because Rehoboam humbled himself, the Lord's anger turned from him, and he was not totally destroyed. Indeed, there was some good in Judah." So here you see the response. He actually responds by humbling himself, by accepting God's judgment, by recognizing God is God. Yahweh is God. Yahweh is in control. Just as he recognized it early in his kingship and not going after and fighting against Jeroboam, we see him recognizing it here. Even though he worshipped other gods, deep down he recognized that Yahweh is God and he accepted God's judgment. And then as a result, God said, "Okay, because you have turned to me, because you have repented, then I will not destroy you, but you'll be subject to Shishak so that you know the difference between serving me and serving other kings." Okay? So we see Rehoboam, we see a volcano there, and that reminds us that under Rehoboam, Egypt became a political threat to the south. And so that's what we have there. Now, how could Shishak have learned about the weaknesses of Judah and got some of his intelligence? We'll turn back to 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 40. We see Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam. This is back when Jeroboam was told by the prophet Ahijah that he would be the next king of the north, and Solomon tried to kill him, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt, to Shishak, the king, and stayed there until Solomon's death. So Jeroboam had spent time with Shishak. Shishak learned more about the wealth and vulnerabilities of Judah and probably was more prepared then to come and attack Judah at this time than what he otherwise would have been. Okay? Well, that's Rehoboam. So let's go on. Let's talk about his son. After Rehoboam dies, we then have Abijah. 1 Kings 15, it says, in the 18th year of the reign of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, so this is still while Jeroboam was king of the north, Abijah became king of Judah, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 3 years. His mother's name was Maasha, the daughter of Abishalom. He committed all the sins his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his forefather had been. So there we go. He was the son of Rehoboam and Maacah. Abishalom is the same as Absalom. So he was Absalom's granddaughter. So Abijah was Absalom's great-grandson. Who was Absalom? Absalom was one of the sons of David, the one who had decided he wanted to be king and staged a coup and fought against his own dad for control of the nation. Okay. What does it say here? It says he was evil like his father. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, committed all the sins that his father had done before him. His heart was not fully devoted. So we see he's also a bad mostly in the technical term on page 10. Were the two kingdoms more friendly during Abijah's reign? Verse 6, there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam throughout Abijah's lifetime. So no, this civil strife continued through the reign of Abijah. And as we know, until the time of Jehoshaphat and Ahab, as we've talked before, and we'll see that further as we go on. Now we do see a story where Jeroboam, after he had some victories against the Moabites, he felt full of power and he decided he wanted to fight Abijah. He wanted to fight Judah. And Abijah tried to stop him. We see this in 2 Chronicles chapter 13. It says, Abijah went into battle with a force of 400,000 able fighting men, and Jeroboam drew up a battle line against them with 800,000 troops, able troops. That was verse 3. Abijah stood on Mount Zemaraim in the hill country of Ephraim and said, Jeroboam and all of Israel, listen to me. Don't you know that Yahweh, the God of Israel, has given the kingship of Israel to David and his descendants forever by a covenant of salt? And now you plan, verse 8, to resist the kingdom of Yahweh, which is in the hands of David's descendants. You are indeed a vast army and have with you the golden calves that Jeroboam made to be your gods. Okay, but as for us, Yahweh is our God, and we have not forsaken him. The priests who serve Yahweh are sons of Aaron, and the Levites assist them. So here, Abijah is pointing out, we still worship Yahweh. Now, they also worshiped other gods, too, but they did have priests and Levites, and they did have faithful, and they did have, out of all the world, this is where you had the most faithful people to Yahweh, was in Judah. He says, we've got God's faithful, Yahweh's faithful people here. So, verse 12, don't you realize that God is with us? He's our leader. His priests, with their trumpets, will sound the battle cry against you. Men of Israel, don't fight against Yahweh, the God of your fathers, because you will not succeed. So he warned him. He said, God's with us. You've rejected him, so you'll lose, so don't fight us. We're not wanting to fight you. And you shouldn't want to fight us because you should realize you're going to lose. So what happened? Verse 13. Now Jeroboam had sent troops around to the rear so that while he was in front of Judah, the ambush was behind them. Judah turned and saw that they were being attacked at both front and rear. So then they cried out to Yahweh. The priests blew their trumpets and the men of Judah raised their battle cry. At the sound of their battle cry, God routed Jeroboam and all of Israel before Abijah and Judah. Verse 18, the men of Israel were subdued on that occasion, and the men of Judah were victorious because they relied on Yahweh, the God of their fathers. So even though Jeroboam had a great strategic plan, and it was playing out, he couldn't fight against Yahweh. Yahweh, God, was the more powerful and brought victory to Abijah and to the southern nation of Judah. Okay? So there's the story of Abijah. Who came next? Chapter 14, Abijah rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, and Asa, his son, succeeded him as king. And in his days, the country was at peace for 10 years. Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of Yahweh his God. He removed the foreign altars in the high places. He smashed the sacred stones and cut down the Asherah poles. He commanded Judah to seek Yahweh, the God of their fathers, and to obey his laws and commands. He removed the high places and incense altars in every town in Judah, and the kingdom was at peace under him. Now we get a good one. Okay, now we get Asa who comes in and returns Judah to faithfulness. Gets rid of all the foreign gods that his father and grandfather had worshipped and had put into place. Gets rid of all the altars and the sacred stones and the Asherah poles and incense altars and the high places, all of that, and returns Israel to faithfulness in God. How great is that? How extensive were his reforms? Take a look at what he even did. Kings 15, verse 11. Asa did what was right in the eyes of Yahweh as his father David had done. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land and got rid of all the idols his father had made. He even deposed his grandmother Maacah. Okay, that was Abijah's mom. He even deposed her as queen mother because she had made a repulsive Asherah pole. Asa cut the pole down and burned it in the Kidron Valley. So here you see his reforms were so extensive he even deposed his grandmother. Let's see a couple other verses here. Although he did not remove the high places, Asa's heart was fully committed to Yahweh all of his life. He brought into the temple of Yahweh the silver and gold and the articles that he and his father had dedicated. Okay, so he brought treasures back into the temple. Remember, the treasures that Solomon had put in the temple were all taken by Shishak. So if someone's looking for the treasures of Solomon, you're not going to find it anywhere but Egypt, because Shishak took them and it probably just dispersed them and turned them into his own goods and melted them down, whatever he might have done. So you're not going to find a hoard of treasures anywhere from that. Okay, so Asa was faithful. So how did God respond to that? Well, 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 9 says that Zerah the Cushite marched out against them with a vast army and 300 chariots and came as far as Marasha. And then verse 12, the Lord struck down the Cushites before Asa and Judah. The Cushites fled. So they had this big threat, this big invasion of the Cushites from Africa. And what happened? God fought for them. God struck them down. God gave victory to Asa and the Cushites left. So he gave success there. Then chapter 15, verse 19 says there was no more war until the 35th year of Asa's reign. So many, many years of peace because of Asa's faithfulness. And then what? What happened after the 35 years? It says there's no more war. It says in the 36th year, chapter 16, of Asa's reign, Baasha, the king of Israel, went up against Judah and fortified Ramah to prevent anyone from leaving or entering the territory of Asa, king of Judah. So he came and besieged the nation, basically. He closed the border so that people couldn't come and go. Now they could go to the south, but what's that? That's a desert. So they couldn't go north and go anywhere. So how did Asa respond to this? Asa then took the silver and gold out of the treasuries of the Lord's temple and of his own palace and sent it to Ben-Hadad, the king of Aram, who was ruling in Damascus. Okay? Aram is Syria. That's the enemy of Israel on the northern part of Israel. So he sent money to Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, and said, "Let there be a treaty between me and you, and as there was between my father and your father. See, I'm sending you silver and gold. Now break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me." Ben-Hadad agreed with Asa and sent the commanders of his forces against the towns of Israel. They conquered Ijon, Dan, Abel-Maim, and all the store cities of Naphtali. When Baasha heard this, he stopped building Ramah and abandoned his work. Then King Asa brought all the men of Judah, and they carried away from Ramah the stones and timber Baasha had been using, and with them he built up Geba and Mizpah. So what did he do when he was threatened by Baasha closing the borders? Rather than turning to God, right? That's what he should have done, right? Rather than turning to God, he turned to Ben-Hadad. He turned to Syria. He turned to Israel's enemy and looked for political help, military help, rather than God's help. And that help came, and that help eliminate the problem. But how did God react to that? Verse 7, at that time, Hanani the seer came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Aram and not on Yahweh your God, the army of the king of Aram has escaped from your hands. Were not the Cushites and Libyans a mighty army with great numbers of chariots and horsemen? Yet when you relied on Yahweh then, he delivered them into your hand. For the eyes of Yahweh range throughout the whole earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. You have done a foolish thing, and from now on, you will be at war. So as a result of him turning to Ben-Hadad, of him turning to Syria instead of to Yahweh, he was going to see warfare for the rest of his reign. Okay, and so that's how it changed after the 35th year of Asa. And the rest of his reign, you see, he reigned for 41 years. So the next 5 years were filled with warfare because he didn't turn to God. He turned to the Syrians for help. And we see that even continued, even towards the end. In the 39th year of his reign, in verse 12, Asa was afflicted with a disease in his feet. Though his disease was severe, even in his illness, he did not seek help from Yahweh, but only from the physicians. So he has lost his faithfulness in terms of looking to God first for help. He didn't even turn to God. He didn't even ask God for help with his foot disease. Rather, he looked only to the doctors. Does that mean he shouldn't have looked to the doctors? No, but he could use the doctors, but he needed to look to Yahweh, needed to look to God. When we have troubles, when we have a health problem, yes, we use doctors, but God wants us to turn to him. We turn to God first, and we turn to God and then use the resources that he gives us. So, Asa had a great start, but kind of flubbed it a little bit there at the end, right? But for the most part, he was good. He brought a good 35 years of faithfulness, returned Israel to faithfulness in God, and then we see his son, okay? His son was a jumping guy, right? Jumping Jehoshaphat. I don't know where that term came from, but it's not biblical that he was a jumper. But we see in chapter 17 that Jehoshaphat, Asa's son, succeeded him as king and strengthened himself against Israel. He stationed troops in all the fortified cities of Judah and put garrisons in Judah and all the towns of Ephraim that his father Asa had captured. Yahweh was with Jehoshaphat because in his early years he walked in the ways his father David had followed. He did not consult the Baals, but he sought God, the God of his father, and followed his commands rather than the practices of Israel. So Asa's son was Jehoshaphat, and he walked, at least in his early years, it says, in the ways of his father David. He was faithful to God. He continued the reforms of his father Asa. We see some examples of that. Verse 6, it says, Jehoshaphat's heart was devoted to the ways of Yahweh. Furthermore, he removed the high places that Asa, his father, had not removed, and the Asherah poles from Judah. In the third year of his reign, he sent officials Ben-Hael, Obadiah, Zechariah, Nathanael, and Micaiah to teach in the towns of Judah. And with them were all these Levites, etc. And then verse 9, they taught throughout Judah, taking with them the book of the law of Yahweh. They went around to all the towns of Judah and taught the people. So we see that the law had been abandoned under Rehoboam, okay, after his third year when he felt secure in his position. And now the people didn't know the law, and Jehoshaphat made sure they did. And he sent his people around to educate the people in God's law. And then, chapter 19, verses 5 to 7, Jehoshaphat appointed judges in the land in each of the fortified cities of Judah. He told them, consider carefully what you do, because you're not judging for man, but for Yahweh, who is with you whenever you give a verdict. Now, let the fear of Yahweh be upon you. Judge carefully, for with Yahweh our God there is no injustice or partiality or bribery. So he appointed judges and commanded them to be faithful, commanded them to give God's rulings, not their rulings, commanded them to follow God and recognize that they were representing God in making these decisions. So, how did God respond to Jehoshaphat's faithfulness? Chapter 17, verse 5, it says, Yahweh established the kingdom under his control, and all Judah brought gifts to Jehoshaphat so that he had great wealth and honor. And then verse 10, the fear of Yahweh fell on all the kingdoms of the land surrounding Judah so that they did not make war with Jehoshaphat. Some Philistines brought Jehoshaphat gifts and silver as tribute, and the Arabs brought him flocks, 7,700 rams and 7,700 goats. Jehoshaphat became more and more powerful. He built forts and store cities in Judah and had large supplies in the towns of Judah. He also kept experienced fighting men in Judah. So we see that he was given peace. He was given wealth. Okay, he received tribute from the Philistines and from the Arabs, and also his own people gave him gifts. He had a time of peace. He was given great power. So this is a strong period. And Jehoshaphat was a strong king because of his faithfulness and the way then that God blessed him because of his faithfulness. Okay? Now, Jehoshaphat was king at the same time as, and this is kind of a high point in Judah's time, right, of faithfulness. At the same time, what was happening on the other side of the border in Israel? You had Omri and Ahab. You had Ahab there. Ahab, this being the worst time for Israel and all the Baal worship that came in. If you remember, Ahab was the last king of civil strife, and civil strife ended during his reign. How did that happen? Okay, 2 Chronicles 18, verse 1. Jehoshaphat had great wealth and honor, and he allied himself with Ahab by marriage. So we have peace brought between the north and the south, done so by marriage. Just like Solomon had done. He married other wives of the daughters of various kings, and that brought a peace between those two nations. Well, Jehoshaphat had his son Jehoram get married to the daughter of Ahab. Her name was Athaliah. And so we have this marriage that brought peace, but it also brought trouble. Okay, take a look at our picture. You've got this white flag, the peace flag, on Jehoshaphat there. And that reminds us that during Jehoshaphat's reign, the civil war between the north and the south ended. Okay, we had a time of peace. The wedding ring at the bottom of that reminds us that that was done because of this marriage, this alliance by marriage between the north and the south royalty. Okay, that's how the peace came about. But if you look closely at the ring, there's a smudge on it. And that smudge is really a big smudge. And that reminds us that this marriage created big problems for the southern nation of Judah. Because this alliance by marriage came to the daughter of Ahab, Ahab being the worst. The daughter of Ahab, the daughter of Jezebel, who brought this Baalism into the northern nation of Israel. And if we kind of look ahead, you'll see a snake on the next kings under Jehoram and Ahaziah and Athaliah. And that brought in a period of Baalism into the southern nation of Judah. So even though the time of Jehoshaphat was a good time of faithfulness, it also brought in the worst time of Baalism because of this alliance with the north. Okay, so a bad decision here. It was maybe good for peace, but bad for peace with God and what that brought. So we see some other examples of alliances here in verse 3. Ahab, king of Israel, asked Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, "Will you go with me against Ramoth-Gilead?" Jehoshaphat replied, "I am as you are, and my people as your people. We will join with you in the war." So he joined Ahab in battle against Aram, against Syria, at Ramoth-Gilead. And you've got a very interesting story there throughout the whole rest of that chapter in terms of some of the what the prophets had to say and the difference between a God prophet and a Baal prophet. And recommend that you read that on your own, verses 2 through 34. Then in 2 Kings 3, we see another example of alliance here. 2 Kings 3, verse 7, and again, you've got the whole chapter that tells you the whole story. Okay, verse 7. He, being Joram, the son of Ahab, who's king at this time, Joram sent this message to Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Will you go with me to fight against Moab? I will go with you, he replied. I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses. And then we've got an interesting story there too. But you've got Jehoshaphat allying himself with Israel during this horrible time of Israel under Ahab and under his son Joram. And what does that do? That results in a horrible time for Israel. Jehoshaphat doesn't catch this, but God does. And look at what God says to him in verse 2 of chapter 19, 2 Chronicles. Jehu the seer, the son of Hanani, went out to meet him and said to the king, should you help the wicked and love those who hate Yahweh? Because of this, the wrath of Yahweh is upon you. What are you doing teaming up with the worst people, the people who are about as against me as you can get? Why are you allying yourselves with them instead of with me? As a result, the wrath of God is going to be on you. Even though there's some good in you, okay, verse 3, there is, however, some good in you, for you've rid the land of the Asherah poles and have set your heart on seeking God, but you've made this horrible decision to ally yourself with these Baal worshippers who have rejected me. So as a result, the wrath of the Lord is upon you. And so we have some stories of some of that, but especially we see in chapter 20, verse 35 to 37, we see later Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, made an alliance with Ahaziah, king of Israel, okay, another king of Israel, who was guilty of wickedness. He agreed with him to construct a fleet of trading ships. After these were built at Ezion-Geber, Eleazar, son of Dodahabu, of Merishah, prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, because you have made an alliance with Ahaziah, the Lord will destroy what you have made. The ships were wrecked and were not able to set sail to trade. Okay, so a fleet of trading ships that Jehoshaphat had built with Ahaziah were wrecked. And that was in God's judgment against his alliance with that northern nation. Alright, now we also have another story in chapter 20 that continues to show us a little bit about Jehoshaphat. It says, after this, the Moabites and Ammonites with some of the Munites came to make war on Jehoshaphat. Okay, this is some of the wrath of God allowing him to be attacked. Some men came out and told Jehoshaphat, a vast army is coming against you from Edom, from the other side of the sea. It's already in Hazazon-Tamar, that is, in Gedi. Alarmed, what did Jehoshaphat do? Jehoshaphat resolved to inquire of the Lord, and he proclaimed a fast for all of Judah. The people of Judah came together to seek help from Yahweh. Indeed, they came from every town in Judah to seek him. So you see that he still had a heart towards God. Even though he didn't have discernment that kept him away from teaming up with Ahab and Joram and Ahaziah, the guys of the north, he still turned back to God. And because of his faithfulness and turning to him, we see verse 15, he said, listen, King Jehoshaphat and all who listen in Judah and Jerusalem, this is what the Lord says to you. Do not be afraid or discouraged because of this vast army, for the battle's not yours, but God's. Then verse 22, as they began to sing and praise, Yahweh sent ambushes against the men of Ammon and Moab and Mount Seir who were invading Judah, and they were defeated. The men of Ammon and Moab rose up against the men from Mount Seir to destroy and annihilate them. After they finished slaughtering the men from Seir, they helped to destroy one another. So God had the Ammonite, Moabite, and Munite armies turn on each other and fight each other so that the men of Judah did not even have to fight against them, and they had this victory without even fighting. So God brought this victory because Jehoshaphat had humbled himself, had called for this fast, and called for all of Israel to inquire of God when faced with this threat. Okay? Totally different than what we've seen with the reaction of kings who didn't turn to God when they had a need. So what does this tell us for our own lives? God wants us to turn to him when we have needs. All right. Next king. Next king we see is Jehoram. Okay? If you look at your picture. Second Chronicles chapter 21, verses 1 and 6. When Jehoshaphat rested with his fathers and was buried with them in the city of David, Jehoram his son succeeded him as king. And then verse 6, he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel as the house of Ahab had done, for he married a daughter of Ahab. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. So now all this good and faithfulness that Jehoshaphat and his father Asa had brought are now gone. Jehoram has married Athaliah, the daughter of Ahab, and that Baal worship is brought in from the north, and that becomes the worship of the south. And Jehoram turns Israel away from Yahweh, brings in this time of Baal worship, which we see as the snake on that starts on his thing there. Verse 11, it says, he had also built high places on the hills of Judah and caused the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves and had led Judah astray. Okay. So we have God being rejected here during the time of Jehoram. We even see initial signs of that. The kind of person that Jehoram was going to be, way back in verse 4, at the beginning of his reign, it says, when Jehoram established himself firmly over his father's kingdom, he put all of his brothers to the sword, along with some of the princes of Israel. So to make sure that he would be the king and stay the king, he had all of his brothers killed off. What a horrible thing. That shows you the kind of person that Jehoram was. So if you look, you see he was bad. Okay, he only reigned 8 years here. How did God punish Jehoram for his faithlessness? Well, that's a lot of what we see in chapter 21. Verses 8 to 10 says, in the time of Jehoram, Edom rebelled against Judah and set up his own king. So Jehoram went there with his officers and all of his chariots. The Edomites surrounded him and his chariot commanders, but he rose up and broke through by night. To this day, Edom has been in rebellion against Judah. Libna revolted at the same time because Jehoram had forsaken Yahweh, the God of his fathers. So because of his faithlessness, God allowed Edom and Libna to come and rebel against Judah. 16 to 17. Yahweh aroused against Jehoram the hostility of the Philistines and of the Arabs who lived near the Cushites. They attacked Judah, invaded it, and carried off all the goods found in the king's palace together with his sons and wives. Not a son was left to him except for Ahaziah the youngest. So here we see that God allowed the Philistines and Arabs, who under Jehoshaphat had been subject to Judah and paid tribute to Judah, now they come in and are victorious over Judah, and they take all the wealth out of his palace as well as his sons and his wives. Okay, he loses his family, he loses his treasures. Why? Because of his faithlessness to God. But it doesn't end there. Verse 12, Jehoram received a letter from Elijah the prophet. This is the time Elijah was the prophet up in the north. Okay, this is time during Ahab and his descendants, right? And he received a letter from Elijah. It says, this is what Yahweh, the God of your father David, says. You have not walked in the ways of your father Jehoshaphat or of Asa, king of Judah. Okay, the two good guys who returned Israel or returned Judah back to God. But you have walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, Ahab, Ahaziah, those guys. And you have led Judah and the people of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves, just as the house of Ahab did. You have also murdered your own brothers, members of your own father's house, men who were better than you. So now, the Lord is about to strike your people, your sons, your wives, and everything that is yours with a heavy blow. You yourself will be ill with a lingering disease of the bowels until the disease causes your bowels to come out. And then we have the story about how he was attacked by the Philistines and Arabs and all of his family was taken. And then verse 18, after all this, Yahweh afflicted Jehoram with an incurable disease of the bowels. In the course of time, at the end of the second year, his bowels came out because of the disease and he died in great pain. His people made no fire in his honor as they had for his fathers. Okay, so we see that as predicted, foretold, prophesied by Elijah, he died painfully from this bowel disease. So Jehoram was not a good one. And Jehoram was not good because of his wife. Just like his father-in-law, Ahab, okay, Ahab was a bad one because of his wife Jezebel. Well, his wife Athaliah brought in this Baal worship and turned him and Israel away from God and created big problems for Israel. Then his son Ahaziah takes over. Chapter 22, the people of Jerusalem made Ahaziah Jehoram's youngest son king in his place, since the raiders who came with the Arabs in the camp had killed all the other older sons. So Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem. How long? 1 year. His mother's name was Athaliah, a granddaughter of Omri. Okay. So his son, Jehoram's son, through Athaliah, that hadn't been captured by the Arabs, became king, Ahaziah. Now this, you see, his name is very similar to the Ahaziah that we found in the northern nation of Israel, because that was his uncle. Okay, so he's kind of named after his uncle. So that's how we see, we get a lot of names, and at the bottom of the page you can see some of the different names and how they related on the north and the south, because we get a Jehoram on both sides and Ahaziah on both sides, and it's all at the same time frame. Hopefully this chart at the bottom will help you see that. Okay, verse 3 and 4. He too walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother encouraged him in doing wrong. He did evil in the eyes of Yahweh, as the house of Ahab had done, for after his father's death, they became his advisors to his undoing. So he walked in the ways not of his grandfather Jehoshaphat, but rather of his father-in-law, or his grandfather-in-law, I guess his other grandfather, Ahab, okay? And he looked to Ahab's house. He looked to Israel for advisors. This is all during the time of Baal worship up there, and so we had this Baal worship down here. So not a good time. Well, he was only around for a year. Why so short? Verses 8 and 9. While Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab. Who was Jehu? If you remember back to our kings of the north, Jehu was the guy, the commander of the army that God had called to come and take the nation away and to wipe out the family of Omri, okay, because of all their sins. And Jehu made that purge and purged the Baalism out of Israel, all that, okay. So while Jehu was executing judgment on the house of Ahab, he found the princes of Judah and the sons of Ahaziah's relatives who had been attending Ahaziah, and he killed them. He then went in search of Ahaziah, and his men captured him while he was hiding in Samaria. He was brought to Jehu and put to death. They buried him, for they said he was a son of Jehoshaphat who sought the Lord with all his heart. So there was no one in the house of Ahaziah powerful enough to retain the kingdom. So Ahaziah was killed by Jehu in this purge of Omri's house. Unlike the other kings, they did bury him because he was a descendant of Jehoshaphat. Okay, so they treated his corpse with a little bit of respect because of Jehoshaphat. Okay. So that was Ahaziah. The next one is Athaliah. Who was Athaliah? Chapter 22, verse 2. Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 1 year. His mother's name was Athaliah. She was a granddaughter of Omri, the daughter of Ahab. So when Ahaziah, her son, died, which was after Jehoram, her husband, had died, she decided she wanted to be king. Now, Ahaziah, or Jehoram, had kind of had taken care of some of that by killing his brothers to protect his throne, right? And now Athaliah is taking over. And what, she's the one who brought all the trouble on Judah, and now she is the queen. She's not a descendant of David, right? But she's not the king either. Okay, so David will always have a king on the throne. There is this period of 6 years while Athaliah is the queen where there is no king on the throne. What was her top priority when she took rule? Verse 10, when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she proceeded to destroy the whole royal family of the house of Judah. She proceeded to destroy all of David's line, getting rid of anyone who was part of Judah's royal family. She wasn't really part of it. She had married into it, and her son had been king and her husband had been king, but now she wipes everyone else out. So what does that mean for David's lineage? What does that mean for God's promise to David that he would always have a king on the throne? What would happen after Athaliah? Well, this is like one of those old shows from the 60s. You'll just have to tune in next week. Same bat time, same bat channel, right? Right now we've got the royal family of Judah being destroyed. What does that mean? What does that leave? Okay? And that's where we'll pick up next week. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the stories that you've given us, the examples of people interacting with you, the examples of people who feel like they can do it on their own and they put their trust in themselves or other people or other gods, and how that always fails in contrast with those who put their faith in you. That as we see that in our own lives, as we put our faith in you, that you're there, you're just, you're loving, you're gracious, and you work your good through all things for us. Even as we live in this sinful world and bring troubles on ourselves, you can still accomplish your good in our lives through those things. And we thank and praise you for that. Help us to follow the ways of Asa and Jehoshaphat and stay away from the ways of Jehoram and Ahaziah and Athaliah and Rehoboam and Abijah. Thank you for those examples and for the clarity that you bring through these stories of what it is that you want in a relationship with us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.